Hello, my name is Sam Chandra, and this is Deep Sky. On this podcast, we go into conversation, helping you to navigate the collision of artificial intelligence and aviation. I am an airline captain, a student of artificial intelligence, and your guide to navigating the collision of artificial intelligence and aviation. Carbon dioxide emissions have received all of the focus when it comes to aviation and climate change. However, it is a very little known fact that CO2 only comprises 40% of the total warming effect that aviation has on the atmosphere. The other 60% of aviation-induced climate warming comes from contrail formation. It's been found that by rerouting aircraft away from certain parts of the atmosphere, you can prevent contrail formation. This rerouting has a negligible fuel impact in the order of just hundredths of a percent, with a massive atmospheric warming reduction in the order of tens of percent. But how do you do that? Well, this is where this week's guest comes in, Adam Durant. Adam is the CEO of Satavia, a software company that has developed the atmospheric modeling and predictive tools required to proactively reroute aircraft and to prevent contrail formation, and in turn eliminating huge portions of aviation's climate impact with technology available today. Without further ado, here is Adam. Could you just take us through how you went from becoming an atmospheric scientist and how did you end up in an aviation deep tech startup?
Hi, Sam. Yeah, great to be here. So yeah, I started off as a scientist working on volcanic ash clouds. So doing things like experiments in labs to understand more about the particles in these clouds. So I became a world expert in volcanic ash clouds. And at the time, it was a fairly niche subject. But fast forward to 2010, I was working as an atmospheric scientist at the University of Cambridge, just started a new job measuring carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. 2 weeks into that, the Iceland volcano erupted, Eyjafjallajökull. If you remember, it grounded European aviation for a week. So created huge costs, huge disruptions. Probably everyone has a story they remember about being stranded somewhere or trying to get home. So that led me to then start working in my first venture. So I wasn't the founder of that company, but I was running flight trials. So we were working alongside Airbus and EasyJet testing a piece of hardware that pilots could use to spot volcanic ash clouds. It was my foray into entrepreneurship. And then I went on to found Satavia at the end of 2013. And we really got going in 2015 with support from the European Space Agency. So we're a data and analytics company based in Cambridge and we're aiming to make aviation smarter and greener.
I came across Satavia a few months ago and you were one of the few voices in the industry that were really talking about contrails as an element of radiative forcing in the atmosphere. And not many other people talk about that. How did you come across this and how are you addressing this largely unspoken of issue in civil aviation?
Yeah, this is a massive issue, actually. So everyone's talking about the impact of carbon emissions from aviation. So it's true, aviation accounts today for about 2.9% of all carbon emissions. But it turns out that two-thirds of the climate impact is coming from the clouds that the aircraft make, the contrails. There's an additional smaller amount that comes from NOx emissions and soot. But basically, two-thirds of the climate impact today comes from the clouds that the aircraft make relative to about a third from the carbon emissions. And that's because the clouds contain water and ice crystals. And the layer that the aircraft make, the cloud layer, the contrail, that actually causes heat that would have escaped to space from the surface to be directed back down again. So it causes surface heating over, on average, across all flights. It's exclusively heating during the nighttime. During the daytime, there can be complicating factors due to other clouds being above or below. It affects the amount of sunlight coming in. That's the basic issue. But it's also a massive opportunity because by making small adjustments to the height or maybe the routing of flight plans with minimal fuel burn impacts, and in fact, you don't have to adjust every flight. It's probably only up to about 5% of flights. Could completely take out this problem. So it boils down to a data and analytics solution to augment what you can currently do with flight planning. And so it's a perfect problem to throw artificial intelligence at. So you're basically going to try and plan flights both to minimize the fuel burn costs and the emissions from the engines, but also to minimize the climate impact, and that's both the direct from the emissions and the indirect from the clients that the aircraft make. So you're absolutely right. It's not being widely accepted, if you like, by the industry, partly because it's not regulated today, but there is growing momentum around regulation. I think the first working group was formed in 2016 by Greener by Design, the Royal Aeronautical Society, NATS and DLR. The first trials are actually taking place involving air traffic management. So DLR, DWD, Eurocontrol are currently doing a 12-month trial, just making small adjustments via air traffic control over the Maastricht upper air region. Today, we've just completed the first dry run flight planning exercise with a major Middle Eastern aircraft operator. So we've been looking at the viability of doing this, looking at things like the impact on fuel burn, the impact on segment times, and cost, of course, of flying through different regions of airspace. So it's a multivariate problem that existing legacy flight planning software can't deal with. So what it's pointing towards is deeper integration, new algorithms to do flight planning, and we can solve all these problems pretty quickly. So then it comes really down to human barriers and the cost of integration versus decarbonisation, which is a hugely costly issue and is going to take decades to solve.
So what does that really look like for the changes in flight paths? You say it's a 5% also change. And what savings in radiative forcing are you looking at with those flight path changes?
If we start with the size of the problem, I guess what really focused us onto this issue was some research that came out towards the end of last year from a consortium of universities led by Manchester Metropolitan University, David Lee. And they looked at 18 years worth of climate data, looked at all of human forcing on climate, and determined overall aviation accounts for 3.5%. So that's 3.5% of total human impact, of which a third comes from the carbon emissions and two-thirds comes from the clouds that aircraft make. So that means the clouds that aircraft make actually account for 2% of all human climate change. So that was the kind of moment we realized, hang on, this is a really big problem, but actually we can do something about this almost today because this is a flight planning solution. So that was really the bit of research that helped focus us on the issue. Since then, I've been building out our science team. We've been developing new science in addition to building on decades worth of existing scientific research to, first of all, predict in the atmosphere when you do weather forecasting where you're going to form contrails. And it's not just forming a contrail, it's actually predicting contrails that are going to last long enough to have an impact on climate. So the first step really is just adding an extra, if you like, weather data layer into existing flight planning software, which enables the flight optimization algorithm just to have another dimension, which is go the most efficient route, fly over certain waypoints, avoid dangerous airspace, avoid hazardous weather, and try not to make contrails. And that's something that we could do pretty much today. And as I said, it's just human barriers and software integration that would hold us back from actually getting that to a productized capability. And that can be done really quickly. The next step would be what we're working on actually is to provide some incentive to the airlines to actually do this, which is outside of regulation. So we're actually developing a carbon offsets credit methodology. Right. So this would mean if you modify a flight, we can then quantify the benefit, the climate saving that we've generated in terms of a carbon dioxide equivalent unit. Right. And then that could be traded on a voluntary carbon emissions trading scheme. That could actually generate a net profit for the airline, so it would cover the cost and actually possibly even generate some revenue, or you can use it to offset the direct emissions. So that's the sort of the two-year vision. We want to be trading carbon offset credits next year, and that's the incentive for doing this and the business model for doing this as well. And that's all on the backdrop of regulation is coming. A big piece of regulatory work has been done by EASA this year, setting the scene for indirect impacts of climate impacts of aviation and feeding that into CORSIA, for example. Yeah, that's the backdrop to all of this.
That's fascinating. The carbon dioxide E equivalent, am I right in saying it generally doesn't take into account the water vapor? It takes into account sort of nitrous oxide or those greenhouse gases, but not necessarily water?
carbon dioxide equivalent is the unit that we can there compare direct carbon emissions against non-carbon impacts on climate. So it can be anything really. What it boils down to is we need to be able to calculate the radiative forcing at the surface of whatever it is causing a forcing on climate in watts per meter squared. And if you can do that, once you do that, you convert that watts per meter squared into an equivalent carbon dioxide mass. So then we can just compare like for like. So that could be the effect of an aerosol on climate or dust, for example. You could calculate the watts per meter squared and convert it into a carbon dioxide equivalent unit. So that's really what we're trying to do with this methodology. And it requires a lot of validation work. So we're spending a lot of effort over the next 12 months validating our capability. So that will be validating the inputs into our weather model, but also once we've made a prediction about whether a flight creates contrails or not, the flight could be flown and we can then look to see if we actually made contrails. So for that, we would be using satellite observations. We're asking some of the OEMs to support us in this work. So maybe we can use testbed aircraft, for example. Maybe the airlines can support us with just engaging through flight ops activities, but also maybe we can put cameras on airlines and look for contrails. So there's a lot of exciting stuff that we're going to be doing over the next 12 months, hopefully to reassure the industry that, first of all, we can do this accurately. And secondly, we can actually build a viable business model of doing this. So minimizes any cost to the operators.
Where do you get your information from? Is it just everywhere, or do you have to set up a proprietary stream?
Great question. So we're getting to the core of the technology that we've built. So the history to this is we've been a partner on an Aerospace Technology Institute project, which is a research organization in the UK, which provides grant funding to do aerospace related research. So we've been a partner on a project with Rolls-Royce and GKN called DIISA. And this has been supporting icing certification of Rolls-Royce's upcoming UltraFan engine. So for 3 years, we've built a commercial cloud-based infrastructure to run science-grade weather models. Typically, these weather models run on institutional hardware, supercomputers in a fixed place, and they're not very portable in terms of putting them into the commercial cloud run by the likes of Microsoft and AWS. So a lot of the work we've been doing is, first of all, to get these models to run in the commercial cloud so we can scale the infrastructure, high-performance computer that when needed. And then secondly, building data pipelines. So what data do we need to run the model? Well, we start with what's called data assimilated data. So this is observations, radiosonde measurements, satellite measurements, surface-based measurements that are assimilated together using a model to create a global scale observational data set. So one example is GFS in the States. So pretty much everyone that does weather modeling needs this starting point to run a more complex physics-based model. So we take the data assimilation, we drive the weather model with that, and then we start doing incredibly high resolution forecasting. So we're running at about 5 by 5 kilometers at 60 levels, up to 60,000 feet, flight level 600. The reason we're doing that is through our work on the DIISA project, we were looking at high altitude ice crystal icing conditions. Cruise altitude weather basically is what we're trying to achieve here. You need to do very high resolution grids. So we found the optimal resolution requires a lot more compute than is typically used for weather forecasting. Hence, we've got a good relationship with Microsoft and AWS to scale our infrastructure. And then we spent a lot of time validating against the METAR data, radiosonde data, in terms of vertical profiles of temperature and humidity. So we were doing all of that before the contrail issue really became centerpiece to support ice crystal icing issues. So the same kind of thing that brought down Air France in 2009, trying to predict those conditions. So once we've invested in all of that research and then the contrails issue comes along, it's not so dissimilar. We need to know how much water there is and whether a cloud will form and stay there long enough to impact climate. So that's almost like bread and butter coming out of the capability we've developed for a different but related purpose. So yeah, that's the background to our technology.
Was it serendipitous that this contrail issue came along? Were you looking for it?
The contrail issue has been on our radar for a while. In fact, we were already prototyping a contrails product at the beginning of 2020. Interestingly, in the first lockdown, we were all working from home from 1 week to the next. For us as a software company, it was absolutely fine. It had no impact on how he operated, but it meant that people were sat at home. And at the time, it was very good weather in the UK. And so people spent a lot of time sitting outside and aircraft were grounded, but occasionally aircraft would fly overhead. And so we started actually validating the contrails predictions that we were already working on through our own team, crowdsourcing observations, taking photographs of aeroplanes flying overhead. And they were pretty easy to identify because there was hardly any planes flying. So we'd go to one of the ADS-B websites and figure out which aircraft it was. So that's how we started it. We were already doing it. And then this sort of monumental piece of work came out, which put everything into perspective. And we realized suddenly this is a massive issue and we should focus on it. And that led us to applying to Aviation X Lab, which is a Dubai-based incubator. It's got the backing of Emirates, Airbus, Thales, Collins, and GE. And we proposed to work with Emirates to start looking at the feasibility of doing this in an operational environment. So that led us to doing our first, if you like, dry run flight planning exercises, just to look at all of those dimensions and possible cost impacts, but also learned a lot about how this could be implemented operationally.
Could you expand perhaps on what that looks like in terms of what do you have to change in the flight plan to have a significant change in the climate impact?
Yeah, so going top down, both the direct and indirect forcing from aviation, we're looking at close to 3 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent per year for the across all flights top down. The contrails account for about two-thirds of that, so about 1.9 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, according to this Lietau paper that came out. There's other work done out of Imperial that suggests that we don't need to modify every flight plan. In fact, it's probably close to about one in 50 flights or one in 20 flights that we actually need to ultimately modify. So the reason for that, not every flight creates a contrail, and not every flight that does create a contrail produces one that lasts long enough to impact climate. So one of the pieces of work we did was to look at Emirates flights from January to April of this year, using all of our own data, just looking at where they were flying and how much time the aircraft for each flight spent in contrail-forming conditions. Right. So we did that by analysing flight by flight through a huge amount of data that we created for the Earth's atmosphere. So we have a lot of historical data. We've effectively created a digital twin of the Earth's atmosphere. So we flew all of those aircraft flights through our historical atmosphere. We analysed that 30% of those flights spent at least 10 minutes or more in contrail-forming conditions. And ultimately, we looked at over 30,000 flights and we had a distribution of time spent in contrail forming conditions. So as would be expected, there's a lot more flights spending short amounts of time in contrail forming conditions. And there's a smaller number of flights that spend a long time in contrail forming conditions. So it follows that if you target just a subset of that distribution, go for the ones that spend the longest time in the contrail forming conditions, modify those, and you can take out a large chunk or the majority of the forcing that will be generated by those flights. So that's the approach. We just target the flights that spend the longest times initially, and then we can scale up to a certain point. But we would never try to actually take 100% of them because you get diminishing returns. Mm. So it does require a change in altitude routing, potentially come to a small fuel burn penalty just to change the altitude, or to fly at a slightly lower altitude where the air might be slightly denser. Mm. So that's the trade-off. We have to model all of that. We have to be able to get to understanding, is it more beneficial to burn a little bit of extra fuel to change altitude in terms of the saving you're going to get from not making the clouds? And it follows that it doesn't make sense to do every single flight. So that also gives us a good strategy to work with the airlines. We don't need to change every flight. We can start with just modifying a very small number of flights each day, maybe less than five as a starting point. And we'll get a huge amount of value from doing that. So the way it would work, the way it did work in this particular exercise that we did, it was entirely manual. So ultimately all of this would be automated out. But the day before, we'd have a look at the schedule of the airline for the following day. So we did a longer term forecast. We estimated flight numbers, which would have the highest impact. And then on the day of the exercise, we requested the briefing packs of those flights. We ingest those flight plans into our platform, and then we can analyze the the direct and indirect impact of those flights, and then using both a performance model of the aircraft and a model that calculates the forcing of the contrails, we can decide whether we fly above or below the contrail forming layer, or if we try and route around it. And then we give back some suggestions, some waypoints, and modified flight levels to the airline to refile the flight plan. We had varying degrees of success doing this fully manual process because we were blind to air traffic rules, which can change on the day according to events that may happen out of our control, according to traffic buildup. So it's all pointed towards closer integration. You can solve a lot of these optimization problems. But we still had a good rate of success of actually creating a valid flight plan. We only added on average between 1% and 2% fuel burn, but again, we had a very poor quality performance model that we were using. That can be improved. We added a bit of extra time to the segments, a few minutes, but again, that could be improved through closer integration. So our 12-month plan really is to integrate the software, improve the performance modeling, and get the fuel burn down to a few tenths of percent in the flight that we would modify. But we'd probably only do up to 5% of all flights. So 5% of a few tenths of a percent is actually going to be the daily fuel burn penalty, which is almost negligible. But we could save for an airline the size of Emirates, modifying 5% of their flights, which would roughly be about 12 flights today, we could save 200,000 kilotons of carbon dioxide equivalent forcing and only generate a fuel burn penalty of a few hundreds of percent. So that's what we're aiming for in the next 12 months. And then the tradable value of carbon offsets credits, if we can do that, would be around about $3.5 million a year profit. That's where we're trying to get to.
That's incredible. At 200,000 kilotons of CO2 equivalent, what percentage of the total current CO2 equivalent would that represent for someone like Emirates?
That would be solving 20% of the contrails problem.
Oh, wow.
So okay. We would then, you know, aim to scale that up even more, possibly getting close to 1 million tons carbon dioxide equivalent once fully scaled and operational.
So you can add a few tenths of percent to the total fuel bill and take, say, 10% of the climate effect of an airline off the books. That's fascinating and huge amount of value to be unlocked with predictive flight planning. I had my very first predictive flight planning experience with a mob called Safety Line. You're probably aware of them with their OptiClimb solution. My very last flight I had 2 nights ago, and it's amazing what you can do when you're using cloud compute predictive atmospheric models and how you can just optimize things in a tiny way. So that is seems to be the way that the industry is going. Where does Satavia take this? How far do you go, and do you address the aviation-induced cloudiness problem as well? Do you integrate with perhaps flight planning systems more fully? What's your vision for Satavia and your solutions?
We're aiming to integrate with all existing flight planning solutions and to work with organizations that specialize in modeling aircraft performance, for example, taking data from the flight management systems. So we need to form partnerships to solve this problem. That's 100%. Right. Certainty. We need capability that also predicts future aircraft movements, so air traffic flow predictions. And we also need to be able to work across different segments of the industry, so commercial, defense, business jets. And we're looking at all of those. Just to clarify a point on the fuel burn, though. So in a flight, so where we're aiming to get to with that, this is the main barrier to the way that airlines currently rate their performance. They have a KPI that measures the performance of the flight ops about how much fuel they consume. So the people running these organizations, the divisions of these organizations, focus only on fuel burn and the cost of fuel. And so if you come along and say, I need to increase your fuel burn even by a tenth of a percent for one flight, then there's a lot of friction.
Yes.
So there really needs to be some forwards looking thinking around this, which also adds an extra KPI, which is climate impact or sustainability KPI. I know some airlines are already doing that and some are thinking about doing that. But then, yeah, bearing in mind, we don't need to do every single flight. If it's only 5% of all flights that we modify, and in a flight that we do modify, we're aiming for a 0.1% penalty, then we're in hundredth of a percent across all flights in a given day. So it's negligible. So positioning against something like sustainable aviation fuel. So the cost of SAF basically hit six times kerosene last year when the kerosene price got so low. Yet the airlines are fully invested in this. The Department of Energy in the US has just put out a 10-year challenge to get the cost of green hydrogen down 80%. That's going to be a requirement to get the price of SAF down. It can be used as a feedstock. And then Airbus has also just announced that they're going to have their entire type fleet certified by 2030 to run on SAF. So it's going to take 10 to 20 years to get the industry decarbonized and running on SAF. And even SAF has a carbon footprint. If you remember, the emissions account for 30% roughly of the overall impact. Actually, in the best case, we'll be able to solve 80% of that 30%. So about a quarter of aviation's impact can be solved through decarbonizing using SAF, and it'll take 10 to 20 years. And that still leaves the contrails. It really requires some forward-looking thinking here and action because it's a low-hanging fruit. It's a data analytics solution. The total cost is going to be tenths of a percent at worst, relative to maybe 500% increase today per flight for SAF. It's a no-brainer, basically. If you really want to do something about climate change, focus on the clouds because we can do it today. And there's another consideration as well around hydrogen. So if you use hydrogen propulsion in the future, like some well-known OEMs are talking about, then you're going to emit maybe four times more water into the atmosphere, which will have a tendency to produce more contrails, which have a stronger forcing than the carbon released during combustion, which might mean you could make the problem worse than it is today if you don't sort out the contrail clouds. So contrails management is a critical part of whatever technology strategy we put in place for the future, and we can already start solving it today, I guess is the key message.
And that is what strikes me so strongly, is that it doesn't matter if you have SAF, it doesn't matter if you have hydrogen combustion solutions, or even worse, and we're still going to need contrail management, and that still will be the majority of the gains when it comes to reducing aviation's climate impact. And you're right, it's happening right now. It's such a fascinating company, and it's going to be essential from today till we have battery electric aircraft flying to the other side of the world, which is going to be a very long time. So thank you very much for chatting, Adam. It's been a fascinating short chat unpacking what you're doing at Satavia, what the problem is, and how you're solving it.
Been a pleasure. Thanks, Sam.
Well, thank you for listening to another episode of Deep Sky. I found this conversation particularly enlightening as we unpacked the role that contrails play in climate change and uncovered the opportunity to change this situation today. It's rare that you come across such a simple solution to such a large problem, and I suspect we will be hearing a lot more from them in the future. As Adam said in our discussion, they are looking to expand their reach and partner with the right people, so please do reach out to them at satavia.com. This will be in the show notes. If you have any questions about the future of artificial intelligence in aviation, or would like to have a chat about how AI may impact your business or career in the future, then please send me an email at samuel.chandra01@gmail.com. The email address is in the show notes. Please do come back next time for another engaging conversation. This is Deep Sky.